So good morning to everyone, and so glad you're here. And as Lyndall said, we're going to be, Jerry and Lyndall and I are going to be offering some reflections on the Oxfording pictures. You know, we're a little more than halfway through the year and the pictures. And we thought it might be a good time to reflect on how this is being for everyone and some thoughts about moving ahead. It's our hope that these reflections will be useful to you all as you consider exploring how, you know, this exploring our path of practice, how it's being for you. This year has been pretty interesting, filled with Dhamma and challenges, and some of us had some resistance when we first started looking at these Oxfording pictures. But as the year unfolded, I think we've learned a lot about ourselves. You know, in the Theravadin tradition, we study the Four Noble Truths, the Three Characteristics, the Eightfold Path, etc. And these teachings are like a roadmap for our practice and our lives. The Oxfording pictures are a bit more like studying poetry, intuitive, using Lyndall's word of mysterious. They're more like a puzzle than a roadmap. And yet I think we've persevered and we've had a pretty good time of it these first 7 months. Early on, when Tewari and Tim announced that this was what we were going to study for this year, Tewari met with the Sunday team, and she said, just share your own experience, your where you are on the path of practice, how you understand each picture. And we've been doing that. You know, we've been doing it individually and as a team. And as we studied the first six or seven pictures and the stages of the path, it's been, you know, kind of straightforward, although I agree with Lyndall, can't really use that word, but we found that we could really identify with the stages of the path and share honestly from our own experience. It's been such a lovely process listening to all of you who come on Sundays, sharing honestly from your own experience. You know, we've really been exploring this path together. And now we're going into some new territory, especially with pictures 8 and 9, but 7 as well. You know, when we first started the year, I think Tewari said, now don't look ahead, just stay with the picture that you're working with. But all of us on the Sunday team looked ahead and we said, wow, this is really new territory. Instead of another step on the path, it feels like a huge leap. And there's some uncertainty. So next month is picture 7, which is a time to really go inward. There's no ox. We're there in our own hut, our own practice. We're meditating and contemplating. And then there's pictures 8 and 9. So as I've reflected on where we're going, there are two Dhamma issues that really come up for me, especially as I think about these next three pictures. And those two issues are anatta, or not self, and nibbana, or enlightenment. Over the last couple months, if you've come to Sunday, you've heard me say that I thought that there were some pictures missing back around pictures 4 and 5 with it. And so I gave a talk on dukkha and anicca, impermanence, and anatta. And now we're here. I've had experiences where I can see selfing happen, you know, making it all about me, thinking that this being is this self that I am so attached to is permanent and substantial. You know, I've really experienced how that selfing feels in the heart, body, and mind. And I've been able to kind of pause and, you know, reflect and investigate and hopefully respond skillfully. And I know that these selfing experiences are only a piece of actually letting go of the sense of a solid, substantial, continuous, substantive self. I understand anatta pretty well conceptually, but not as well actually embodying it. I notice over and over again my attachment to certain identities and the times that I make experiences all about me. I've had glimpses of small moments when excuse me, those identities kind of come and go and don't stick so strong to me. But there are also many more moments when I seem to live and act from those identities. So this practice of anatta, really important and challenging, and I think that's part of what we're going to be asked to do in these next months. The next thing that really strikes me about these pictures, 8 and 9, kind of flowing from the teachings of anatta, is that they refer to awakening, enlightenment, nirvana. We don't talk a whole lot about that ultimate freedom. I've heard teachers that have come to SINS comment that Westerners especially often don't give ourselves, enough credit for being able to fully awaken. For me, I've always appreciated the way Joseph Goldstein refers to enlightenment as small moments many times. Now, is there one big moment of awakening as we read in the suttas? Or is Joseph correct? Or is it a both and? Do I prefer Joseph's perspective because it resonates more with my own personal experience? Do I need to deepen my efforts? Am I just kind of treading water in my practice? Are the teachers right about us doubting whether we actually believe that we're able to awaken? You know, the Buddha said he wouldn't ask us to do this if he didn't believe fully that we were capable of it. But is this kind of doubt with a capital D a little different twist on doubt than what Lindell shared in the poem? I mean, not really different, but maybe just more of that. I know that these small moments where I experience glimpses of awakening in the now, but have I ever really cultivated a deep aspiration for that big moment? You know, here in Seattle Insight, both on Sundays and Mondays and Thursdays and all the times that we get together, we honor where each of us is on the path. We see desire that arises for being somewhere else, you know, setting a goal of getting on with it, being further ahead, you know, that kind of striving to be somewhere else than we are. And just like in a sit, when we notice a mind that's filled with planning or futurizing and we want a different mind, we want that concentrated, attentive mind, but sometimes it just isn't there. And are we at a place in this year where the message is, keep practicing at being with wherever we are, being with whatever has arisen, whatever is present? Or are we also at a place where we are being called to set a bigger aspiration? Is there a place of balance where we can do both, honor where we are and continue to inspire each other to deepen our practice? You know, we know what we know and we honor that. We also wanted to honor what we don't know. And we'd like to know how this is being for you. How are you practicing with these big Dhamma issues? You know, how do you understand anatta and the letting go of self, of making everything about me and mine? How do you think about awakening? So those are some of my reflections that I've kicked off this conversation. And Jerry and Lindell and I have not shared with each other what we're sharing with you all. So I'm going to turn it over to Lindell. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Suze. And I'm not quite sure how to start in responding to what you said and sharing what I was thinking about in a way that relates to it. I totally agree. You know, we're moving into this territory that's kind of maybe newer and more mysterious and more unknown. And one of the things that I definitely notice that you were just talking about with these pictures is our tendency to want to make progress, and the fact that wanting to make progress makes it hard for us to really honor the place where the ox herder is in each of these pictures. Or in our own practice, the place we are in our own practice. You know, I think one of the things that we've noticed all of us doing when we have our discussions for getting ready for teaching on Sunday is that when we kind of want to be further than we are, we'll give the ox herder all sorts of wisdom and skills and traits that they maybe don't really have yet, because we're kind of wanting to be at the end, be at the end. Or maybe on the other hand, we focus on what the ox herder doesn't know, or what he or she is doing or not doing that maybe isn't so skillful. And I think Tweri reminded us that we need to look at those things. And yet, when we notice those things, it's really easy to take them as something that we need to fix, and that is the, you know, that we're doing wrong, or the ox herder is doing wrong. And yet, the truth is, you know, when the ox herder is in that place, you know, they can't really fix whatever it is they're doing, because they don't know what they need to know to fix it. And so I think that's something important for us to remember with ourselves too, that sometimes we can't make ourselves understand more just by wanting to understand more. We have to let that understanding arise by continuing to look. And this sort of gets at that question that Suze has brought up about our doubt about our ability to really awaken. How far can we go? I think this is one of the things that will be really challenging for us to explore as we go through these pictures. My own sense is that it's not either small moments many times or a more deeper experience. It's kind of both. And, you know, we might have a deep realization, but then with all of our practice, our understanding of, you know, anatta, say, it just sort of seeps in until we have a kind of a feeling of all of these things that happen in our body, our mind. It feels like it is, but somehow on some level we recognize it's not really me. It's not really mine. It's not really what I am. So it's sort of both, you know. But the way that happens is a mysterious thing, and I think I certainly feel like I have some understanding, but there's more to be known, definitely more to be known. And the way that these things are known, I'll mention one more thing because I don't want to take up too much time, is that with these pictures, I feel like they do a really good job of getting the feel of what it's like to be in these different phases of practice. And yet, as we've talked about, during especially the last month or so, it feels like there are pieces left out. And the way that these things unfold in the Zen practice, there's lots of commonality with our own Theravada tradition, but it isn't quite the same. It's sort of like this journey to emptiness, maybe, in the Zen pictures, that just sort of flows in this smooth way, where we are always talking about the journey from suffering to the end of suffering, and having to experience suffering along the way, and having to experience the three characteristics along the way. And you can't really get to that calm place until you've had enough suffering to be able to say, okay, I'm just going to be with what is. So it's like we might struggle. I know that I have kind of struggled fitting my own experience in with the Zen pictures, and maybe a lot of you are feeling that same way, that this doesn't quite fit with my own practice experiences. And so I'm hoping that we're addressing this as we go along in our discussion of the pictures. And so it's going to be challenging, but maybe really keeping in mind that as we've been saying all along, there's no one interpretation. Just as there's no one interpretation of the pictures, there's no one single path to awakening. And I think we have our own unique opening. So, you know, maybe really keep that in mind as we go forward, you know, honor our own experience and recognize that everybody has their own journey. So maybe I'll let Jerry talk now so he has some opportunity to share too. So thank you for listening, everybody.
Thanks, Lyndall. Yeah, I appreciate what both of you have said about these oxfording stories, pictures, poems. Sue's alluded to the fact that some people were enthusiastic and others were less so as we embarked on this journey. I think I was on the latter group, a little less so. But there's, I gotta say, I come around to it. You know, I like to know what do I do and how do I do it? And that's kind of how I approach a lot of things. And that's one thing I've liked about the Theravadan tradition. You know, it's the Four Noble Truths. This is, you know, mindfulness practice. This is how you do it. This is how you go about doing it. It's important to recognize what your inclinations. It's important to see greed, hatred, and delusion arise and pass. And just to see it's as something that can be done. It's something that can be used to relate to things, to relate to the reality of life in this moment. So I value that. Approaching it in the Zen fashion of this big picture of using poems, using imagery. So it takes a bit for me to come around to it. But I see the value. I really do see the value. And I think so our getting together in this little panel discussion, I think helped me reflect on that. And reflection is part of what the value is. As I look at my spiritual journey, I wouldn't even be inclined to call it a spiritual journey. I won't go into that too far. But I'm caught in my own story. You know, I'm right here now. This is my own story. And I don't often look back. You know, I just kind of move forward and I kind of consider what's next. And I think what these oxfording pictures have done is create an opportunity. I think it depicts what a spiritual journey looks like. It's a certain universality that it presents. The universality of, you start out. You know, everybody is somehow trying to make sense out of their lives, trying to navigate this territory. And some people are so caught up in just surviving that's the limit of their exploration, just trying to put food on the table, just trying to, you know, deal with day to days. But I think some people have that opportunity to consider the bigger pictures, so they can actually pursue a spiritual journey. What else? What's beyond this? What's beyond this material world? And I think that's what this oxfording pictures do. It starts out with a search. You know, the search of, well, what's out there? And the search comes out of necessity, where I gotta find something else. Like my current situation is too difficult, I need something else. Or it could come out of curiosity. Wow, what is this world? What's this all about? What happens next? I would say my, you know, in terms of this one, I would say I was in the latter category. And then there's, you know, as going from that to the searching to the finding. I mean, you're finding footprints in terms of the ox writing things. You're seeing the ox. You're catching the ox. So there's the finding. It's, oh, yeah, I connect with this. This resonates with me. There's something, there's a truth about this that I can relate to. And you open up to that and you continue on in that vein. And initially it's with confidence. I said, this is really good stuff. This is opening my heart. This is opening my mind. This is, I want to pursue this. And this is how I do it. And that the initial shine on that discovery, the beauty of that discovery, runs into reality. It runs into the challenges. And I think that that's described in the ox herding pictures. You know, first of all, oh, there's the ox. Oh, now we got to tame this ox. And there's a struggle. And I think we all have our struggles. You know, certainly as we learn how to meditate, we came out of our, you know, sit and feeling, that was a nice relaxing sit. And then we have an expectation, oh, I'm going to do that all the time. And then we realize that we can't do it all the time. And then we realize, oh, I'm still suffering. And I'm suffering around this practice that I thought was going to liberate me, and I'm not. And forget about it, and we have doubts. And I think, as Lyndall was saying, is that what do we do with that doubt? It's like this opportunity. Is this doubt something that all of a sudden go back to our original conditioning and play it out, and we give up on this vision or this inclination we had to see something some way differently? Do we go back to our old conditioning, or we could continue on and open up the door? And our practice in terms of these ox herding pictures, you move on and you can get past that. And now the ox herder is, you know, playing his flute, riding on the way home, under a certain delusion again. I mean, it looks like it's all going to be good from here, you know, just playing his tunes, tapping his hand to the beat. But we all know, we've been there, we've had those experiences, and we run into the challenge of that. We realize that things change. And that gets to be a perspective. We have to start understanding the notion of change. We start understanding the notion of identifying and wanting change to not happen. Start realizing that suffering is going to result if we try to cling to things too much. And so with the ox herding pictures, it goes on. It goes on from the search to the finding to the struggling to gaining confidence and then ultimately opening up, landing, having a new perspective. And that's where this goes. We start out seeing things one way. We go through the challenges of trying something different, looking a different way, trusting that, and ultimately open up to a new perspective. Same external conditions, but now we see these external conditions with a new view, a view that does not cause suffering, a view of full awakening. So I think I'll let it go at that. Thank you. So yeah, I mean, we were going to talk a little bit. Yeah, there's a couple of things you two, Suze and Lyndall, you brought up. And certainly, you mentioned something about doubt. And so why don't we open up the comments that each of us have on one another's, what we have to say.
I have something I'd like to say. I just wanted to say, Suze, I really appreciate the way you are framing these last pictures in this, with this sense of our aspirations for awakening, you know, this sort of sense of, are our aspirations big enough? How do we approach them? Do we need to, what kind of effort is the right sort of effort to actually realize those aspirations? And I feel like this will be a really good discussion if we can get into this in these next months, because I know it's really an important area for me, you know, because striving at some point isn't that helpful, but yet we don't want to be complacent and you know, need to believe that awakening is possible. So thank you.
You're welcome. Well, and it's this exactly the way you've put it is, you know, I can see myself overstriving and like, and that desire to be somewhere I'm not. And yet, you know, I don't know where it comes from, but that idea of practice like your hair is on fire, you know, or Joseph's mantra that anything can happen at any minute, which of course is true. You know, and so what does that do to our sense of urgency? And is, you know, that whole question about effort and keeping it in some kind of balance is, I would welcome that kind of discussion as we move forward.
Yeah, and certainly effort, I don't think it's that balance that you do. I mean, there's no question you need effort. And so, somebody just said something about aspiration. Hang on, we'll give you a chance later, but I just want to make reference to that. Thank you, Rashad. That aspiration, do we have an aspiration? And it's certainly of value to have that, to know where you're going. Otherwise, you're just operating out of your conditioning. But how much is there a clinging to it? Are you insisting on achieving an aspiration at the expense of letting go? If you just insist on it, there's a rigidity that is going to basically deny the possibility of that aspiration.
I wanted people to know that I've just created the breakout groups. So you're going to get plenty of opportunity to talk with each other. And so I didn't want you to feel, Rashab, that you were being cut off. You're going to have an opportunity in a minute. And maybe that's a good time for us to invite people to go to the breakout groups. And with the question of how's this being for you, exploring your practice in this way? Some of the questions that Jerry and Lyndall and I have raised this morning, if those resonate. Thanks, everybody, for staying with us. And Lyndall and Jerry and I didn't talk about who was going to do this. Because I set up the breakout groups, I'm just going to let it start. Feel free to go to the reactions button and or raise your hand, and if you want to share, and we would welcome hearing what anyone has to say about how this is being, what this discussion was like. We had a pretty wonderful one in our group. Lyndall, unmute, yes. And Cheryl.
You know, I was just thinking about Risham had this question about do we need to have aspirations, and I kind of wanted to make sure that got addressed. And I feel like yes, we need to have aspirations, and yet I find it so challenging to have aspirations and yet not get caught up in that sense of making my aspirations all about me. So it, to me, it's a really challenging area of practice. So maybe I'll just leave it at that. And maybe others will want to respond or say something.
I have a question regarding what you just said, which is, for instance, if you have an aspiration to do no harm to yourself or others, or, you know, those kinds of aspirations, show kindness to all. That would not be about yourself.
No.
It's not what you mean. It's like,
no, that's not what I mean.
I want to whatever. Okay. Just clarification. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. Cheryl or Kathy, did one of you want to say, and then maybe Rashab might want to comment since he brought up such a good question.
Yeah. I was going to talk about, you know, in our group, I kind of talked about possibilities, and you know, Lyndall talked about it being, you know, doubt, and I talked about being ignorance. That's how it works in me. And every time so there's definitely an aspiration to be kind, but it's not always, or to, you know, not have aversion or all this other stuff. And they can turn into striving for me also. But the other part of it is they can, you know, I can have a really strong head and it's like, and not see it and believe something that isn't even true. And every time I come to the other side of that, it's like, oh man, that wasn't true. And I held on to it. I mean, this last one, for a couple of months, I was in, you know, and there's so much possibility on the other side of that. So at that point, aspiration becomes easier. I think it's harder when I'm in that place where I'm struggling, and when I'm in a place where it opens up and the possibility feels real. Aspiration feels almost, yeah. For me, it's intention. I think I use the word intention more than I use the word aspiration.
Thank you, Cheryl. Anne Marie posted something in the chat where she said, being kind to others is still about you having an identity around kindness, isn't it? And that's a good point. It can be. I think it can also, you know, when I think about the Bodhisattva vow, there's this huge aspiration, but it's really not about the person. Although I imagine that people who take that vow have some inner struggle about how much of it is personal and identity and look at me and what I can do kind of thing. I think that selfing process is ongoing. That would just be my response. Anne Marie, did you want to say anything else, or Jerry or Lyndall or anybody, about how being kind to others could be a kind of identity thing? Jerry, you're muted.
Yeah, I'll say something. What comes to mind is Sharon Salzberg talking about gift giving. And, you know, there's all kinds of intentions we can have around giving a gift. You know, I give a gift, hopefully they'll like me. Give a gift and, you know, or, you know, it could be just a gift of, you know, I want this person to be happy without that sense of self. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it's hard to have an intention or an aspiration, which is, until we're enlightened, I think it's hard to have it completely free of a sense of self. It's always going to be a little bit there, but that's okay. You know, it doesn't have to be pure. We're works in progress.
Thank you. Was there anyone else who wanted to say anything? This is rich territory here. I love the idea that, you know, we're not only a work in progress, but it's called a practice, which I love that, you know, that we're not, it's not a perfection. Lillian and Nikhil, hi, and welcome from Idaho.
I guess something that kind of came to mind when talking about the selfing with some of these intentions was something I've sometimes heard is that instead of describing yourself as feeling something like feeling I'm angry or I'm sad, I've heard a phrase as anger is present or sadness is present. I'm just kind of curious if you have any thoughts on if that's something that can be applied to intentions as well. Trying to just reframe our perspective on the intention to kind of take self out of it a little bit.
I love that turning it into that passive voice. And it came from some teachings from Joseph Goldstein. I think it's really a useful way, including, you know, I'm just really full of myself, you know, and knowing that, and can I respond and make it more of a passive thing? What is being called for in this moment? How can generosity be manifest in this moment instead of, can I be, you know, it just asking questions where we take some of the I out of the question, I think can be just a useful process. But that would be my first response, Nikhil. I think it's a great arena for exploration. Anyone else want to respond to that or say more, or Nikhil, if you do, or?
I might say that this is a really good area of exploration. And Nikhil, I think your suggestion is really good. And I also, on this whole topic, I found that one of the things that is helpful for me is when I know when I start to have, when I have some sort of intention or aspiration, and I start really struggling with it and really getting upset around it and just having issues and stuff like that, it's usually because that identification has gotten so strong that it's kind of taking over. So I sort of keep trying to notice that when it's happening. And I mean, as Jerry says, there's always going to be some sense of me with these things, but sometimes it's a little bit less and sometimes it's really strong. So I think for me, if I'm really starting to struggle and get upset with myself or those kind of things, that's a sign that it's becoming too much about me. So that's a helpful sign.
We've got time for maybe another comment before we close. I realize I don't think Jerry and Lyndall and I talked about who was closing.
Well, I'll do it.
Thank you. Well, then I will be quiet and let you take over, Lyndall. And
okay.
Thanks.
Well, before I close, I really want to express my appreciation to everybody for being here today and for listening to our panel and participating in this experiment. And I hope that it will, you know, raise some questions and thoughts in your own minds about your own work with these pictures. It was interesting for us, and we weren't quite sure what would happen. So the opportunity for Donna, your contributions to Sims are always appreciated. And your generosity is really what helps this organization keep continuing to exist. So you can go to the website, to the donate button as you feel moved, and share. So to end, let's just sit together for a few moments to close. Recognizing that when we come together like this to practice and to talk about the Dharma, it creates a force for good that we feel and that can be shared with those around us and might benefit and influence them in ways that we can't really even see or imagine. So take a moment to bring to mind someone that you would like to share the merit of this practice with. You know, maybe someone you care for who is living or who has passed away. And just taking a moment for that sharing. And then letting that sharing extend to a wider and wider circle of beings. All of us here today, everybody in our neighborhoods, the country, the world. May all beings near and far, seen and unseen, share in the merit of our practice. May they be happy. May they be peaceful, and may they find freedom. So thank you everybody for joining us today and hope you have a wonderful day. Keep as cool as you can, enjoying the sunshine.
Feel free to unmute and say goodbye, and we'll see you all soon, hopefully. Mm-hmm.